Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of December 6th, 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good, 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 good. And today we're also pleased to be joined by a man who has served many different roles in carbon tax movement here, in particular with the Citizens Carbon Lobby. Did I get that right? And he's served in various positions here in Massachusetts in terms of organizing the Citizens Climate Lobby. It's Dr. Gary Rusinski. How you doing, Gary?
Good, Ted. How are you?
Good. Welcome aboard. So a couple episodes ago, we had a discussion. In fact, we've had two episodes dedicated to talking about something called the Green New Deal, which is a proposal. It's basically an idea more than a concrete proposal, but it's an idea in front of Congress, driven mostly by Alexandria Cortez, to have a special committee to formulate legislation, sweeping legislation to address the issue of climate change. So there's that. And in parallel, there is a different bill in front, well, has been proposed, I guess. So Gary, tell me, there's a different approach being taken within Congress. And Gary, tell me about what that other approach is.
Sure. So actually, this approach is the one that Citizens Climate Lobby has been working on for the last 10 years. They started as an organization and immediately began promoting the concept of a revenue-neutral carbon tax. And what they mean by that is a gradually increasing fee on fossil fuels proportional to the amount of CO2 that would be emitted when burned. And that fee would go up year over year. And by driving a increase in the cost of fossil fuels, renewable energy, conservation, and efficiency would begin to look more economically attractive in contrast. And so today, where fossil fuels are so cheap and renewable energy is struggling to, you know, reach economies of scale and drive their prices down, this would attack the problem from the other direction by simply making the incumbent fossil fuels more expensive and make them pay for the true cost, make their prices reflect their true costs in terms of damage to the environment. Again, by comparison with the emerging clean energy regime. Now, nobody likes taxes. And nobody wants to just arbitrarily drive up the cost of energy, because that's a very regressive policy. And so Citizens Climate Lobby has always paired that fee with the concept of returning all the revenue to households. And when they return the revenue to households, they do it on an equal basis. So all households get the same check, regardless of demographics. So it doesn't matter how much money you make, what tax bracket you're in, everybody's going to get the same check, similar to what they do with the Alaska Permanent Fund, where they get the royalties from the fossil fuel companies for extraction, and they distribute that uniformly across their population every year. So that's what Citizens Climate Lobby has been working on for the last 10 years. And literally last Tuesday, a week ago, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago now, three Democrats and two Republicans have embraced this concept and come out with a bill in the House of Representatives that's called the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. And it is, by and large, I mean, we can get into the details.
Let me just interrupt, but that I love the acronym. It's EICDA, right? Which sounds kind of scary. It's not pronounceable, but EICDA is this bill. Okay. Continue.
Probably just as well that it's not pronounceable, because then somebody would make fun of it, right? So, EICDA. We can get into the details, but it is, by and large, the Citizens Climate Lobby proposal. They have the same fee structure as Citizens Climate Lobby has been proposing. They propose returning 100% of the revenue raised to households on a flat basis. They propose a border adjustment so that companies aren't encouraged to take their production offshore and ship it back unaffected by an energy fee. And so, again, we can get into some of the nuance if you like. But again, by and large, at the kind of 90% level, it is the same bill.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we know from economic studies that this is going to be a very effective way of driving down emissions. We know that it's going to create jobs, more jobs than we'll have than even as a in a business as usual case.
Mm-hmm.
We know that it's good for people, both from their income standpoint, as well as from their health outcomes. And the bill is revenue neutral. We're not proposing any new government programs or any new costs to government or to taxpayers. And finally, you know, three Democrats and two Republicans originally, a third Republican has signed on. And so this has true equal bipartisan support, which is something that's really rare in Washington.
I noticed. I got a bunch of questions. So first of all, how do you determine the fee? I think I know the answer, but you tell me. Is it written into the bill? Is it based on some sort of cost of living style increase that the feds compute each year?
No, the fee was the fee structure that Citizens Climate Lobby proposed was $15 per ton of CO2 equivalent emissions in the first year, and that would add about 15 cents to a gallon of gas at the pump.
Mm-hmm.
And then $10 additional every year thereafter until emissions reach sustainable levels.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably what happens is the fee goes up, the cost of fossil fuel energy goes up, more renewables come online, people are encouraged economically to buy electric vehicles and heat their homes using heat pumps rather than fuels. And so,
but I mean, the bill does not. So I guess I thought you were going to say it was this arcane number called the social cost of carbon that's computed by the federal government as the cost of a the impact of a X amount of carbon emissions. But you're saying the bill sets a number, presumably computed somewhere, that the $15 a ton or whatever the number is, there's been some research to say that this is the right level that would drive an economic response, right?
Well, actually, the benchmark or the kind of back of the envelope calculation that was done was, if we do this, $15 initially and $10 additional every year thereafter, in about 10 years, you would reach parity between the cost of fossil fuels and the cost of renewable energy.
Okay. Go ahead.
You didn't want to, you know, we didn't want to shock the economy by jumping immediately to $105 per ton.
Right. the other question that usually I hear, and of course I've been arguing for price on carbon in this podcast for a long time, I've taken to calling for a fair and equitable, you know, long-term and equitable price on carbon. So how do you manage the impact of a carbon tax on people who, let's just say, are at the lower economic end of the spectrum or have jobs that are very much dependent on fossil fuels, say a truck driver, and especially in light of what's going on with this yellow vest movement over in France, where they're going to take Macron out over a gasoline tax. I mean, my question is there a way to soften the blow and get buy-in from people who might be out of money, you know, short-term on a weekly basis?
The bill actually has something that we did, that CCL was not proposing originally, and that is that there's what we call a prebate.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the month prior to the fee kicking in, we're actually going to distribute the anticipated proceeds a month ahead of time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that even in that first month, households will have the check in hand before the energy price inflation from the fee begins to work its way through the economy.
So I guess that answers the question. Is it's the other question is this is not going to be some desiccated number on your tax form, so you get a kickback at, you know, in April. What happens is you're going to see a check every month, like from Social Security under this, and, right? And you see that check come in every month, right?
Exactly. And it's cash. It's not a voucher. It's not a a credit or anything like that. It's just cash.
Hard cash. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So in our previous discussions, we wondered out loud on this podcast, or I wondered, is it sufficient to, is putting a price on carbon sufficient? That is to say, I think Mariah was making the case that a carbon tax, I won't say the carbon fee and dividend, great. It caps the economic, it makes the economics of addressing climate change predictable, because you know the price of carbon is going to go up by a certain amount. But if you want to, if you're rich enough, you can just pay the tax. And so you're not capping the emissions. Whereas a cap and trade caps the emissions, right, and lets the price fluctuate. So there's, you know, double-edged sword there. But, I mean, do you think that, that if we had a carbon fee and dividend, that by itself would resolve the issues on the time scale that we see? I mean, we just had this report that we all have to act within 12 years. Do you think that the carbon tax would get us there in 12 years, or is the carbon tax a down payment on additional activities?
I think the carbon tax is the first best step that we can take, but it's not sufficient to get us out of our the hole we've dug ourselves in. You know, this is only going to deal with future emissions. There's nothing we can do about past emissions, and there are going to be emissions during the transition to a clean energy economy. So the atmospheric concentration of CO2 is going to continue to go up with this policy. Now, on the other hand, you know, the question is there a faster way to reduce emissions than what this will bring? And, you know, short of the government taking over the car factories and dictating that every vehicle built from now on will be electric, full electric, and then figuring out where all that electricity is going to come from in a very short time frame, I don't see how you do it. The economy, you know, in that in the IPCC report, I believe there was this line that was quoted that where they said, in order to avoid going above the 1.5 degree Celsius limit, was going to require a transformation that was unprecedented in human history. And that's all well and good. You know, yes, we can all recognize that challenge, but I think that we also have to recognize that we have unprecedented ability to transform today that didn't exist in the past, in the form of, you know, all of the computing power we have available to us, the machine learning, artificial intelligence, the research and development into energy storage systems, windmills, solar cells, that the price of solar and wind, you know, basically plummeting over the last decade. All of these things and the, you know, the growing popularity of electric vehicles. All of these things make me very optimistic that many of these economic studies that we have, they cannot anticipate the degree to which innovation will contribute to solving the problem. I'm very optimistic about that.
Interesting. So I guess, so tell me, this is a bipartisan proposal. It has been put into the, or will be put into the next Congress, right? There were these six guys, six people. Are there any, DR, looking at you, are there any kind of poison pills in this legislation that we should be aware of? Is there any sort of downside in order to get people to come along with the legislation?
Well, Gary can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe one of the provisions basically essentially suspends, shall we say, the EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act, and believe there was a recent Citizens Climate Lobby conference call, which was basically made clear that that was done in part to secure Republican support, but mm-hmm. it potentially may lose Democratic support. And if I'm correct or incorrect on that, Gary, let me know if my facts are correct.
Well, I can tell you the specific things around regulatory adjustment.
Okay.
Are that, you know, the EPA endangerment finding stands. That is not affected.
Mm-hmm.
CAFE vehicle efficiency standards stand. The ability to regulate methane emissions from natural gas or petroleum systems also stands. And the ability to regulate any greenhouse gas for its impacts on health or welfare also stands. You just can't have a kind of double jeopardy situation where regulating greenhouse gases for their greenhouse gas effects will be prohibited over the course of the next 10 years. But at the end of 10 years, if we are still not meeting our targets, then all of those regulatory, that particular regulatory prohibition comes off.
Mm-hmm.
And the EPA is then free to introduce new greenhouse gas regulations if that's what they feel is needed at that time.
So tell me, do you think that's a good deal? So clearly, Citizens Climate Lobby thinks that is a good deal, right?
We think it's a great deal because, you know, the strongest environmental or greenhouse gas program that we have today is the Clean Power Plan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even Barack Obama said that he has always believed that the most elegant way to drive innovation and reduce carbon emissions is to put a price on it. And the former head of the EPA also agrees that putting a price on carbon is a better solution. And if you look at the emission reductions anticipated under the Clean Power Plan, which of course is currently in litigation, as well as the very strong possibility that it will be rewritten by the Trump administration, which will then go into its own litigation cycle, that even if that plan were implemented fully, and it doesn't even start until 2022, that it's only it's a mere fraction of what you will get in terms of emission reductions from a price on carbon.
Right. So you say the real world circumstance that the EPA's plan that began with the coal plants is so tied up and is relatively small compared to the benefit that you would get by having a carbon tax, that the carbon fee and dividend, that's a net winner. And in 10 years, you would suspect we would come around and have to reimpose EPA regulation, right?
Well, that in 10 years, you will be free to impose EPA regulation if the plan is not doing its job. I should also point out that even as this plan goes forward, in any particular year, if we fall short in meeting our goals, because there are annual goals in emission reductions that are anticipated,
mm-hmm.
that if we fall short in meeting those goals, then in the next year, the fee goes up by an additional $5 per ton. Instead of going $10 per ton, it would go up $15 in that year.
Interesting. Sort of a self-correction. Built-in self-correction.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So tell me, Gary, where can people go to learn more? People that are interested in this, what should they do? Who should they talk to? What's the URL for the Carbon Citizen Climate Lobby website? All that kind of stuff.
Well, the best place to go to learn about this plan is a site that's been set up for it. And it's called EnergyInnovationAct.org. EnergyInnovationAct.org.
Got it. Energy Innovation Act. Okay.
Yep.
All right.
If they want to get involved in helping to pass this bill, then they should go to citizensclimatelobby.org.
For all one word, citizensclimatelobby.org. Yep.
Okay. Right. And look into finding a chapter near them, or if they don't find a chapter, start a chapter.
That's right. If you can't find one, start one.
Yeah. And we have our regional conferences coming up in the Northeast. We'll have a regional conference in March.
Okay.
This is a great time to get involved, because then you can go to the regional conference in March. And
do you know yet where that will be?
It's going to be in Eastern New York. I don't remember exactly. It's at a college in Eastern New York.
Super.
You know, just over the border from Massachusetts.
And remind me, the Citizens Climate Lobby has an annual lobbying day in Washington, D.C. sometime in early summer, right, where people go and they're trained and you go in and meet all of your representatives, right?
Right. We go to Washington in June. We have where does it start? No, it starts Sunday. It's a 2-day conference, which is we have been having on the order of 1,300 and 1,400 people come to our conferences. So we spend 2 days in conference learning everything that we need to know, so that on the following Tuesday, we go to prearranged meetings on Capitol Hill. And we meet our representatives and our senators, and we lobby them to build political will for legislation. And this year, obviously, or next year, will obviously be a very big time for us.
Super, super, super. Well, we got to put it down there, Gary. I will put up links to the various the websites you've mentioned on the blog. And that's the blog is at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can get to that, and you can get to the show through our Facebook page. It's /massclimateaction. And, of course, you can listen to this directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, Podbean, all the typical podcast directories nowadays. And, of course, you can go to Apple Podcasts and rank us. It helps other people find us. So, Gary, we're going to close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And Gary, thank you so much for taking the time to come and help us understand more about the energy innovation and carbon, what's the D? Energy Carbon
Dividend
Act. Thank you very much. Everybody,
anytime, Ted. Really enjoyed it.
We'll talk to everyone. We'll talk again soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Very cool.